Hello, and welcome to Cranfield University. In this interview series, we explore the role of philosophy and humanities more generally in management, engineering, and in practical professions in general. My name is Andrei Pavlov, and I'm professor of strategy and performance at the School of Management here at Cranfield.
Hi, my name is Toby Thompson. I'm the studio director here at Cranfield. My interest is in continental philosophy, Heidegger, and executive education.
And in the studio with us today, we've got Frank Boutendijk, the distinguished VP and Gartner Fellow and the co-lead at Gartner Futures Lab. Frank, welcome. Welcome back to Cranfield.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm incredibly happy to be here.
Frank, could I just start with a big question, I suppose? I know that you've spent quite a lot of time, quite a lot of years, looking at the digital technologies in general, and you've taken an ethical perspective on it. So you've explored the digital ethics. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is a field that is exploding at the moment. More questions are coming in than we can answer. Can you tell us a little bit about what digital ethics is and what's going on in this space at the moment?
Yeah, so there's a ton of official definitions of what ethics is about, but in short, it is the study of what is good and what is bad. And we can make it more formal. I think we over-rationalize sometimes ethics a little bit and make it too complicated. Digital ethics is mostly, we'll talk about it a little bit more, but it's mostly an applied ethics. So it means it's the same ethical thoughts that we've developed over the last 4,000 years, depending on how you count, but in the field of digital technology as well. There's some new questions too. But for me, the core of the story is this. Whenever we get confronted with some kind of an innovation, and let's assume for our use case of digital here, it's like some kind of a digital innovation, we have an immediate emotional response of something being cool or something being creepy. It's an immediate intuitive thing that we can notice, like, wow, or hey. What is digital ethics then in practice is the exploration on why we have that immediate reaction and understand our own emotional responses and share those and see what we can do, how we can elevate the good out of it and how we can mitigate the bad. That for me is the core of the matter here. Emotion has an incredibly important part of this. It's the first sense of direction that we have, pretty much on every topic.
So Frank, where does ethics come in then? So when we make those decisions, the yay or yuck?
So ethics, essentially the study of what is good and bad, are it's just different words for yay or yuck or cool or creepy. But I think it does more. Ethics as a formal discipline helps you to think through things. And I think here's the point. If you have an immediate emotional response, then you start to think yourself, like, why am I thinking that way? And if you have a good grasp on what is out there in terms of ethical schools of thought, it'll help you to think through your first emotional response and then your personal response. And first, more rigorously, what does this mean? And then what can I borrow from what has been figured out already? And moreover, ethics is pluralistic. There's no single right or wrong. There's multiple schools of thought. So you can start to apply multiple schools of thought to your inquiry, to your own first reaction, your own analysis, and expand your view on the matter from multiple perspectives. Also understanding where others come from, even if you disagree with them.
So Frank, I want to come back to the digital side of it. The ethics I want to explore some more, but the digital side of it, we all have digits, they're fingers in the human sense. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about here? Are we talking about a physical entity, an artifact? Are we talking about a social institution? Are we talking about a concept? What's the digital side of it?
Yeah, so if you ask seven experts in digital, you get like 12 different definitions of what it stands for. The digital is kind of short for digital technologies. Digital technologies is a little bit of a... how do you call it in English? Like a term that repeats itself. It's modern technology. So we've had multiple ways of digital technologies and subsequent ethical discussion around it. The ethics of social media. I'm not sure if you remember the great societal debate that we had on the upcoming impact of mobile phones and social media before it happened. Maybe you don't remember it. I don't, because it never took place. It just happened, and that too little, too late, and now we're stuck with it. Then we had this whole wave of big data as a second wave of digital technologies that had ethical implications in terms of privacy and then probabilistic modeling and the impact of data on decisions. Now we're in like a digital ethical wave around artificial intelligence. The latest thing being ChatGPT and other large language models, and what that means. And AI starts to raise some more fundamental questions that venture outside of the applied nature of digital ethics. You could also imagine that there's ethics around blockchain, a surprisingly underdeveloped field, ethics of cloud. And personally, I think if we look a little bit more towards the long term, is that the ethics of metaverse are going to be incredibly important. I recently read a fantastic book called Reality Plus that explored the part of that as well. But the ethics of metaverse have the potential to become an even bigger debate than the ethics of AI here.
So digital is a state of mind, by the sound of it.
If we make it like a super dry, not even a definition, but description of it, is that digital is like a set of modern technologies, and even the word technology is ill-defined. Well, okay, from the Greek it is well-defined, but the way how we use it in practice, it's an ill-used and then wide word. So it's kind of hard to don't we all have like an intuitive understanding of what it is? It's essentially, let me put it like this, but half jokingly, it is everything that qualifies for the statement that came from Arthur C. Clarke, the famous science fiction writer, who said that every sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So everything that is magic is digital. That's
very good. So is there, in this space of digital ethics, where all of these questions are being raised, how do we think about it? Is there an approach to think about it? Is there a way of at least, I suppose, organizing yes. these questions into some category? So how do we deal with this?
Yeah, so largely it's an applied ethics. And that means that the normal approaches to ethics that we have in other fields as well apply here too. You can think of it from a universalist perspective, where the benchmark of ethical behavior is the extent to which something something that matches your principles, and if it matches your principles, therewith it is good. You can also look at it from a consequentialist perspective. Different people use different terms, but I like the terms universalist and consequentialist. The consequentialist says that the benchmark of ethical behavior is the extent to which you stick to your is the extent to which the outcomes are positive here. But both of them have their shortcomings. If I would ask everybody who views this interview now, like what would be the 10 principles of the emerging digital society, the only correct answer is I don't know, because they just haven't emerged yet. So how can you have principles? So the universalist approach has some issues with emergent phenomena. And the consequentialist approach can be seen as a little bit too fatalist, if you will. Isn't this stuff a little bit too important to leave to consequence? More specifically, what this is about what this does is that it's... Cranfield, from a background, is an engineering school, and ethics is all the more important for engineers. Ethics tend to torture engineers, because ethics is not a set of problems you can solve. Ethics, that's one view, it's debatable, but I like the view. Ethics is a coping mechanism with reality. Ethics is ambiguous. Ethics is fuzzy. Ethics is very contextual, it's pluralistic. And that means that there's no optimization, there is no single answer. It's just not a set of problems you can solve. And that's why it's such an important topic for engineers, because it teaches you something about this exception to the world called life, and that's important. And another thing is that engineers have the tendency to see how much they can do and how much they can achieve, and ethics changes that frame of what can we do to what should we do. So pretty important questions and ways of thinking for an engineer, I would argue.
Frank, you seem to in your book Socrates Reloaded cover some of this area, and you seem to be comfortable with patrolling the boundaries of what ethics isn't. In terms of rationality, then, let's come at it from one angle, from that boundary. Is rationality relevant to the study that you think we should undertake?
Of course, because it's about an inquiry on why we have that first emotional reaction and figure out why am I thinking this, and why do others respond as they do, and can I understand and analyze their particular responses. The idea, I think, among technology philosophers, the general idea is that we try to answer the question, how do we do things responsibly? It's not very practical to think what can we do, what can we not do. Many things seem to be on some kind of an autonomous path and going to happen anyway. But how can we do things in a responsible manner? And that is not only a process of analysis, that is a process of synthesis, if you will. So ethics, what you know about ethics then in that inquiry is a systematic exploration of different points of view, and what can we find that satisfies multiple points of view instead of just my point of view. And that's a rational approach. At the same time, it was Simon in a couple of decades ago who introduced the term bounded rationality. So there's limitations to our rationality. Sometimes we have irrational behaviors that are relevant as well. Although I would not call emotional irrational, that's a different dimension. They're not each other's opposites. What it means mostly is that we can think things through to a particular extent, to a reasonable extent, but there's always unintended consequences, and that's something that we need to mind as well. We cannot think things through up front and then go for it. There's always interpretations or use cases that emerge that we didn't foresee. Sometimes they're good and then we embrace them. Sometimes we label them as bad and then we correct them. Mm-hmm.
Can I just follow up on this, Frank, but also roll it back a little bit? So Toby mentioned your book, Socrates Reloaded. And one of the aspects about that book that I really liked was that it was not only about ethics, but it was about more fundamental kind of philosophical lens of looking at the IT industry, I suppose, and technology in general. And I think it's quite rare because in a lot of cases, people jump into the ethical discussion and to the ethical implications of technologies, for example, without really analyzing the kind of philosophical foundational mm-hmm. principles behind it. And what you did in that book was amazing. So you correct me if I'm wrong, if I got it wrong, but you looked at the world as it is and you asked, pardon me, how the philosophers would think about this world if they were alive now. Is that...
Yeah, that was a bit of fun. Also an incredibly safe venture to do because most of them are dead, so they wouldn't be able to complain.
Or refute what you're saying.
Exactly. So I was in pretty safe grounds there.
Tell us a little bit more about that book in terms of how it came about, but also what you got out of it.
The my interest in the topic and the book, the writing is one of the best forms of thinking, I would say, because
absolutely.
Every poem is perfect in the head, and it's the moment when you start to write things down. It's you start to get confronted with the shortcomings of your own thinking there. Moreover, and this may sound funny, I just came out of a book that I've been writing on for 4 years that was called Dealing with Dilemmas, and that was... I just wanted to do something light. So I thought, let's write a book about philosophy.
Yeah, very light.
It's the book had a, I had the shape of a number of essays, and it took me about a year to write those essays. And the book is nothing else but a collection of those. And I try to treat it light and lighthearted. As I always say, half of the book is nonsense, and the other half of the book is not. I just don't know which half is which. But the interest started with, I think at one moment, as you can see, I've got some gray hair. At one moment, you need to think, but I think as any professional, not only about the know what, and that's how you start out as a professional, then you move towards the know how. And at one moment, I think you need to move to the know why. Why are we doing this? What are the implications? What is the bigger goal that we're doing this for? The why question. And ultimately, that's a more philosophical question. So it is for me, it was a natural progression of my own thinking about my own field and the books that I've been writing. And it was for my own intellectual curiosity. Then the whole Snowden NSA thing happened. And since then, it's been on everybody's mind and an endless vein of research. I can encourage every person who is looking for a path of lifelong learning to dive into philosophy. It's a dangerous field because at the one moment you start to doubt everything except doubt itself, and nothing is certain anymore. Every time you open a door, there's like three more doors and then three more doors. It's just an endless, endless, endless topic of inspiration and discovery. But moreover, and then if I can make a more like a self-reflective comment here, I think every book that you read says as much or even more about the author than it says about the topic being described in the book. The topic was about philosophy. The previous book was about strategy. The book before was about performance management. In the end, every book is an exploration to oneself, getting closer to yourself. So it's been helping me figure out of what I believe in and what I stand for. I'm sure you have the same thing at Penfield with, and particularly now speaking to the students here. It's wonderful to hear from your professors that there's here's the seven ways of thinking about something, but the professor gets really interesting, and then you really start to learn something when you start to understand what the professor themselves stand for and believe in, and then you start to understand much better why things are being explained the way you are. So it's
no, absolutely, and of course, teaching is also one of the fantastic ways of sorting out your own thinking, just like writing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, cool. Teaching is the best form of learning. Yeah.
So, Frank, in the book, somewhere you talk about being a data therapist, and I'm thinking of the audience for this book. It sounds like you're recommending it either as therapy or as just an opening up of the world, broadening of your perspective. Is that right? Who's the audience and why? Why should they read it?
Interesting that you took out of it. My initial meaning with the idea of data therapy was a little bit more narrow. It was... I wrote a book in the days that the data scientist just came up, and I thought that can't be all in creating those models. And the moment through machine learning systems start to learn, they start to display behaviors. And now we get closer also to why particularly AI is pushing digital ethics outside of its applied nature and raising some fundamental questions. I'm slowly planting some next questions here for you to ask. And so we've seen the same thing recently with ChatGPT that started to misbehave. And what did Microsoft do with its ChatGPT powered Bing search engine is that it immediately restricted what you could do with it. But that's fundamentally not the answer. Building a large language model or building other models based on machine learning is a time consuming and is an expensive thing to do. And it's not everything is possible, but it's not very economical. It's the moment if something works, and just to throw it away. The technologies have a too fundamental role in society moment to make them optional. They're part of the social fabric. So if models learn over time and they start to misbehave in a way as an actor, then they need behavioral therapy. We need to have specialists who know what counter data to feed to the model to counter the undesirable behaviors that they've been displaying. And that's the notion of data therapy. And everybody thought it was funny when the idea came up. Of course, the book was 2012. And by now it isn't called that way, but it's an existing skill set on how to... and I think the parallels with behavioral therapy are enormous. For years, I've had to... Maybe this is an idea for one of the students listening to this. For years, I've had the ambition and never got around to it of taking an overview of the DSM. I'm not sure if it's called that way in English as well, but that's an overview of all mental disorders that are there, and apply them to data and apply them to modern technologies, and see how those human mental disorders translate to technology as well. I think that's I think it's a very fundamental form of research that that may teach us about something about human thinking and the human brain as well.
Just you talking there seems to be two types of time related to what you're saying. That's the digital time, which goes very quickly. It changes. You said you wrote the book in 2012. I'm sure even you'll say things have moved on since then.
Yeah, very much.
So it's very fast and it's hard to keep up. And yet the very slow notion of ethics, of virtue. You haven't mentioned virtue so far. You talk about consequentialism and universalism. How do you reconcile those two types of time?
There is Google something called pace layers. It's a very interesting framework on how the world moves, on how fashion moves really fast, and how humanity and the way how we think moves really slow. And the idea of that model of pace layers by Stuart Brand is that you need to figure out in which cycle of change you are, and the slower the cycle, the more fundamental the thinking, if you will. So I think in that model there's about seven cycles or something. Some cycles just move slower than others, until there's some kind of a shock, and then it changes, and then it moves on again. So sometimes the change, I think, in that sense, is discontinuous. So sometimes there's kind of a shock in thinking, and then one of the slower moving cycles needs to be updated, and then we have what is called a paradigm shift. One of the biggest shocks at the moment that affects the lower moving cycles of change is that that AI raises some more fundamental questions, making that AI ethics is less of an applied field of ethics, and that is machine agency. Machine agency is the capacity to act in a certain context or in a certain environment, and it's been reserved to human beings. We like the life moves. The ontology of the world is as such. There's life, and life moves, and then there's the inanimate world, and that is being moved. So that's how we distinguish them, like the two sides, a simple view of the world. And now all of a sudden there's a thing, a piece of technology, a virtual or physical, a piece of technology, artificial intelligence, that moves. So our carefully crafted and understood mental model of the world is being shocked, and then socially and practically and legally, we just don't know how to deal with machine agency and whose responsibility certain behaviors are. Shall I walk you through some reasoning here? Would that be fun?
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Yeah, so there's multiple positions. Let me ride my hobby horse for a second here. There's multiple positions here. The most common position around technology is that it's always the user who's responsible. They say, particularly in the United States, it's people shoot people, people shoot people, not guns shoot people. So it's always the user who is responsible for this. But let's shake the tree. Particularly technology providers and engineers say, like, you know, I'm just building stuff. What people do with it is their problem, and that's not my concern. But let's shake that tree a little bit. User here is being defined as user as operator. We operate technology. We are at the moment on a Zoom call, And we operate that in order to talk with each other, or I put an invoice in the system and I operate the invoicing system, or I use a baseball bat to hit a ball in the park, and a baseball bat is a simple form of technology as well. And if I would club you over the head with a baseball bat until it really hurts, then you can argue whose fault it is. You would tell me it's my fault because I did it. I would say it's your fault because you were annoying, but it is not the fault of the baseball bat in this position because I'm operating it. But if we take this one step further, we look at a simple Google search. The question is, do I operate Google for a Google search? And I would argue you don't. You interact with Google because there's 30, 40, 50 other factors that are an influence on how we interact with Google as well. I'm not the sole operator here. There is, I can't have the full responsibility of what comes out of it. There was an interesting example on Amazon.com of one person who bought a specific scales for in the kitchen and some fertilizer for in the garden and got recommended the three missing elements to building his own math lab. That was not that person's fault. It was the algorithm. In the end, it was nobody's fault, but certainly not the user. So a Google search moves the definition of user to user as interactor instead of user as operator. Now let's move this one step further. And let's assume we all have domestic robots in the house. And the domestic robots wants to pass and says with a friendly voice, excuse me. You say, oh, sorry, you take a step back. And the robot says, thank you. And you say, you're welcome. You're interacting with that piece of machinery, that robot in a space as you would interact with any other being in that space, and being in that sense is an interesting choice of words. The user relationship has disappeared. We only interact with technology, just not with users anymore. So making everything a user responsibility, the original sense of how we use technology is out of the window. So then the second position is that it is the developer of a technology. I think it was, I always mix them up, but I think it was Aristotle who in the Four Causes said something that every artifact is an instantiation of the ideas of the designer. I think that was the final cause and how he described it. That's an interesting thing, is that every piece of technology therewith represents what the designer wants it to do. And it means that it's the designer responsibility. I've asked for years, I've asked people like, so what is a gun designed to do? And architects, IT architects tend to answer, it's designed to shoot bullets, but that's just avoiding the point. It's designed to kill. An AK-47 is not designed to shoot on tins behind the house or something like that. So there's always a developer responsibility. But let's go back to the Amazon example of the missing ingredients for a math lab. Was that intended by the design of the Amazon recommendation engine? Absolutely not. So machine learning, there's all kinds of unintended things that come out. Again, with ChatGPT at the moment, all kinds of answers that were never intended nor are desirable in a way. So through machine learning, you can't really say it's the responsibility of the designer. So then there's a third position. What would machine responsibility look like? And does it even exist? Will we start treating machines as pets, where they have independent behaviors, but it's always the owner who's responsible for this, so then ownership becomes relevant? Do we treat machines at one moment even as children that we educate, and then they move on and start to operate independently in the world? Or do we treat some technologies as a force of nature? If something goes wrong, it's like a big storm some kind of natural disaster that you can insure yourself against it. So the idea of AI agency fundamentally introduces this new question of machine agency and what that means. And don't ask me for the answer here. It's something that we're going to have to figure out collectively. I don't know. I just love this reasoning. Here, as it's, this is why philosophy is so dangerous. It's nothing is certain anymore.
Can I bring you back to education? You're an educationalist, I can tell just from the way you're talking. is the duty of an educator to expose to the student the complexity that you talked about there? I noticed quite a bit of asymmetry between the user and the designer. How do you see education in this whole thing?
The whole point of education, the whole point of higher education in a university is to make sure that you contribute to critical thinkers that contribute positively to society. There's probably, English is not my mother tongue, so there's probably crisper and better ways of saying it, but for me that's the core of the matter. And that is not done through walking through chapter 3 of the book, explaining everything and then taking a test. The educationalist poses problems to the students and asks them to think about it, to discuss it, come back and come up not only with their own perspective, but with multiple perspectives. And to be able to defend multiple perspectives and that's what creates critical thinking. My own children, I have two teenage daughters, are in an IB school, International Baccalaureate School, where they work exactly like that, an incredibly powerful way of educating people. And I'm sure, particularly in your philosophy classes, you work in similar ways. The master of that, second to you, Toby and Andre, would be Michael Sandel at Harvard, who teaches that way. I can recommend everybody to go on YouTube.
Me too.
And watch his series of short lectures called Justice. It has immensely shaped my thinking and the way on how I present and build arguments. And the influence that Sandel had on at least my professional development cannot be overestimated.
Mm. Can I sort of bring you back to this tension that you've mentioned a couple of times now? So I can sense that you are convinced of the value of philosophy in life and in business, and at the same time, a couple of times you mentioned it's a dangerous thing. So how do you bring it to the business then? How do you take these questions to the business? And how do you sell something that creates uncertainty rather than removes it?
Yeah. So the most dangerous leader is the leader who's absolutely certain. That's the leader who is once in a while extremely successful by complete chance and coincidence, and then more often than not leads a company to the ground. So the best leaders are uncertain and therefore listen to multiple perspectives. The best leaders are analytical, but more than that, they're also synthesists. They are able to connect different perspectives into a single new thing that encompasses all. They don't accept dilemmas in the sense of either this or that, but are and thinkers. How can we do everything at the same time? And you do that through listening and through weighing and valuing uncertainty. Because if you're certain of everything, you don't listen and you're not a synthesist anymore. I think that is an important part of leadership. But here's the dilemma. If you stand on your soapbox in front of 7,000 people on a Zoom call introducing what we're going to do during, I don't know, the next crisis after Corona or the next strategy, and at 3 p.m. the meeting starts, everybody opens their Zoom, and there the CEO stands and says, ladies and gentlemen and everybody, I don't know. That's not the best message. I think the dilemma of the leader is to balance and cherish their own levels of uncertainty and listening, carefully weighing. And even when you take a decision, leaders take decisions under great uncertainty. Our Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, in the Netherlands, in the beginning of the Corona crisis, said, like, look, we're taking decisions all the time with 100% impact based on 50% of information. So some things will work and others will not, and then we need to reconsider. And particularly in times of uncertainty, that is a leadership style that I think that is necessary. At the same time, Leadership itself is extremely necessary in times of uncertainty. We cannot hide behind execution. We cannot hide behind the process. We cannot hide behind a plan. We cannot hide behind a budget. If everything is up in the air all the time and everything is uncertain, we need good old-fashioned leadership in order to move through that uncertainty.
So do you see, I mean, you've worked in the industry for many years and you've worked for companies like Oracle and Gartner, and you've been around, you've spoken to quite a lot of executives as well. Do you see a hunger for philosophy and ethics? Do you see it as an open door, or do you see skepticism and resistance?
Skepticism and resistance. Because it is not a culture in which leaders are being grown, which is about competition. The two philosophers that are valued the most are Machiavelli and Sun Tzu. That's maybe not the broadest of bases. I remember one executive conversation with a CEO of a large company that was about ethics, and I did a presentation there. And then the CEO literally said that he didn't see the complexity. It's really simple. If there's an issue, you go to the regulator, you ask for a ruling, and you stick to it. I was shocked. I was shocked of that level of thinking. I think it was Plato who said, let the philosophers be kings and the kings be philosophers, with a sense of drama and a sense of flair. And maybe that's a little bit too dramatic. If you're not a philosopher, how can you be a leader? If you cannot consider multiple perspectives and then find common ground, if you are not able to critically see through issues and then decompose them, logic is a branch of philosophy as well. As a leader, one of the key tasks of leadership is setting vision for the future. And the future doesn't exist. The future is nothing else but the collective imaginations that we have in the present, as much as history is the collective the collective memories that we have. It is one huge thing called the eternal present. That's at least my perception of time. So one of the key questions in philosophy is, what can we know? And if we apply that to the future, which is, what can we know about the future? And how can we reasonably argue about the future? If you are responsible as a leader, feeding many families, being responsible for the commitment of many different stakeholders, being responsible for vision setting, you must have some vigor in thinking about what can we know about the future and how do we prepare our organization for that. Well, for me, it's a complete no-brainer, and for the life of it, I don't understand why there's skepticism and resistance, other than that most current leaders weren't raised maybe that's the answer. My kids can take philosophy classes in school again. In France, it was never gone, but in many other countries, it's been like, I never took philosophy classes when I was in school. It was simply not on the curriculum and nobody was interested. And I do see a renewed interest for the topics in generations that are future leaders. So Toby and Andre, there's hope.
Obviously,
take a while.
For the three of us, philosophy winds the clock, so to speak, of our days. But for some people, possibly those watching, it doesn't. Is there a simple tip? Sorry to reduce it, but someone watching thinking, oh, okay, I'll give it a go. What would the simplest first thing to be that you'd recommend?
Obviously, take your classes.
Too much. Thanks for the plug, Frank.
Obviously, that's a good. I had to think about it for a second. The father of scenario planning, an ex-Shell person called Pierre Bach, Frenchman, always. Argued you should talk to personnes remarquables, remarkable people, people that are in fields that you're not from, people that have a different way of looking at life, the business, or whatever domain it is about. So So talk to people outside of your little bubble. It's I forgot the name of the book, but I remember Obama was a fan of it, which is like a team of rivals. The name of the book was and make sure that you organize your own debate, and you organize your own resistance as well. I think those are good ways of starting to think more critically by exposing yourself to different styles of thinking, as unpleasant and as much as you disagree with them as they may be.
It's uncomfortable to find someone who disagrees with you completely.
Oh, yeah, of course, yes. Yeah, awkward and comfortable, and that should not be avoided.
Mm.
And that is why universities should be thoroughly uncomfortable to be at in terms of the discussions that you have. And the moment students shy away, it's like, oh, I'm not feeling entirely comfortable with this. That's a warning, a signal, when we should hold it back. Okay.
So if engineers are not feeling comfortable about not being able to use their rationality, that's a good sign. That pain.
That's a good sign. Yes, that's a sign of growth. The feeling of discomfort is a good sign of also in terms of self-reflection of supporting, maybe to get a bit of a big word, but encouraging yourself to open up.
I couldn't agree with you more, Frank, and I also agree that universities should be places where you can feel uncomfortable in a safe environment.
Yes, wow, that is beautifully said.
Yeah. This is how you train your muscle, your critical thinking muscle, your ethical muscle as well.
Yes, yeah, I think. Yeah. Philosophy is nothing else but a set of disciplines that that fuel critical thinking in many ways. What is true? What is real? What is good? What is logic? What is beauty? It's no wonder that the whole concept of university came out of philosophy with Plato's Academy.
Mm. Frank, we are coming up to the end of the interview, and I just wanted to ask you, I suppose, one final question and a slightly personal question. You've done a lot of thinking about this for a long time. What's on your intellectual radar screen at the moment? What's inspiring you at the moment? What books are on your desk? What are you reading?
I'm reading a lot about disruption at the moment, and the nature of that and how you can deal with disruption. Super interesting for people with an engineering background is the whole concept of chaos engineering, and this paradoxical thought that by bringing disturbance to processes and systems, you actually improve their reliability. Mm-hmm. The whole concept of anti-fragility is incredibly interesting. As you mentioned in the introduction, I'm one of the co-leads of the Gartner Futures Lab, where we look at two things. We look at challenging conventional wisdom and exploring what-if-based plausible futures a little bit further out. Last year, we looked at what we call the age of disruptions and everything that comes with it. And this year, we're looking in what factors, what pressures, what new pressures will transform leadership in the next 15 or 20 years. And as you probably noticed during the conversation that we had, I started to touch on leadership quite a bit. In no means am I a huge expert in leadership, but it's fascinating from the background that I do have in ethics and in futuring.
Frank, I'm taking leadership from that Rodin sculpture just over your shoulder there, the thinker. I think you're an inspiration. Clearly, people are interested to carry on more. Is there a new book that you're working on?
No, there's currently no new book that I'm working on, as I'm quite busy with the other things working on at Gardner here. So life is a bit full at the moment.
Mm.
Well, knowing you, Frank, I think if you're not writing a book now, then we can expect a trilogy in 10 years' time.
Oh, one word. I need to retire first, but that is not too far away.
Thank you very much, Frank. This was excellent. We found it fantastic, and we had a lot of fun. I hope you did as well. I'm always glad to see you back at Cranfield, virtually for now, but hopefully in person at some point in the future.
It's one short flight away.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Bye-bye.